and welcome to the Earth Policy Institute, America as China's Farmer conference call. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Ms. Jennifer Mullen. Please go ahead.
Good morning, everyone. This is Jennifer Mullen with the Glover Park Group. I want to thank everyone for getting on the call this morning. We have Lester Brown on the call. He is president of the Earth Policy Institute. He's with us today. He's going to talk about how China's growing demand for food, including imported grain, will affect world food prices. This analysis that Lester will talk through can also be found in his new book, World on the Edge, which can be purchased or downloaded from the Earth Policy Institute website, which is earth-policy.org. We will also be live tweeting the call this morning, Earth Policy Institute will, with the hashtag EPICalcon, T-E-L-C-O-N. And now I'll turn the call over to Lester.
Thank you, Jennifer. China is coming back into the news with some rather strong indications that they were in the U.S. grain market buying corn last week. This has not been officially confirmed, but it seems quite likely. 15 years ago, I wrote an article in World Watch magazine entitled, Who Will Feed China? And that magazine article, we had a press conference during the week. It was late August. Press coverage was moderate but not outstanding. But that Sunday, the Washington Post reprinted the article and put it on the front of the Outlook section and changed the title from Who Will Feed China to How China Will Starve the World. And that got the attention of the Chinese ambassador very quickly. On Monday morning, the Deputy Minister of Agriculture had a press conference in Beijing responding to the analysis and basically saying China has always fed itself and it always will. But they were even then in the process of becoming heavily dependent on imports. Imports were growing. But what happened then was that they began to realize that they had to mobilize in a major way if they wanted to remain self-sufficient in grain. And that's exactly what they did. I did not anticipate the sort of response we got, because though I knew that all the political leaders in Beijing then, and indeed today, are survivors of the Great Famine of 1959-61, when according to official numbers 30 million Chinese starved to death, I hadn't realized the psychological scars that had were left by that experience. So the idea of becoming dependent on the outside world was not something that any political leader in Beijing could accept. So a number of things happened. They made an all-out effort in agriculture. They raised the price support for grain by 40% to encourage farmers to invest. They doubled the amount of farm credit available. They launched a major research effort to raise yields of wheat and rice and corn, which was incidentally very successful. So they did a lot of things. But some of the things they did were not sustainable. And that's one of the problems that they're facing today. For example, they decided they wanted to maintain the cropland area, even though they were losing a lot of cropland, especially in the eastern and southern coastal provinces, to construction, especially industrial construction, as they were building thousands and thousands, actually hundreds of thousands of factories during that period. So to offset that land loss, they required each province to buy land or to acquire land in some of the northern and western provinces and plow that land up, plant it to grain in order to maintain the production base. In fact, most of that land should never have been plowed. It was too arid and eventually was vulnerable to wind erosion. Another interesting thing that happened even before then was that after the reforms in 1978, the government lost control of livestock numbers. And so China's cattle and sheep and goat populations just sort of exploded, because everyone was grazing on the commons, and no village family had any reason to limit the size of their herds or their flocks. So just to give a sense of the pressures that is now putting on China's grazing land, which is comparable to that of the U.S. The U.S. has 82 million head of cattle. China has 97 million head. The U.S. has 9 million sheep and goats. China has 284 million sheep and goats. And they are literally devegetating northern and western China. The result is, from overplowing and overgrazing, is the formation of a huge dust bowl. Similar to that in the U.S. during the 1930s, but far larger. The latest numbers are that China is losing 1,400 square miles of productive land, grassland or cropland, to desert each year. The U.S. Embassy did a report a few years back in which was entitled Desert Desert Expansion and Acquisitions, and it explained how not only were deserts expanding, but they were beginning to merge. So this was actually an article about mergers and acquisitions, which one would initially think was corporations, but it was actually deserts, with large deserts absorbing smaller ones, and then larger deserts merging with each other. And this is all based on information from satellite photographs. Some 24,000 villages, according to the desert researchers in China, have either been abandoned entirely in northwestern China or at least partly depopulated. So this erosion issue and the formation of this dust bowl that creates the dust storms that hit China every year, about this time of the year, hit eastern China, I should say. It's not unusual in Beijing, for example, along with many other cities in the northeast, when these dust storms hit, the cars have to drive with their lights on during the daytime, for example. So it's a major issue, on a far larger scale than the U.S. Dust Bowl in the 1930s. The other thing that the Chinese have done to try to remain self-sufficient in grain production is they've overpumped their aquifers. And this is most important under the North China Plain, which accounts for half of China's wheat production and a third of its corn production. Under the North China Plain, there are two aquifers, a shallow aquifer, which is replenishable, and a deep aquifer, which is a fossil aquifer, that is, it does not recharge. And we're now seeing the depletion of these aquifers. We see it in both reports from within China and also from the World Bank. One of China's leading groundwater experts says the region, and he's talking about the North China Plain, is losing its last water reserve, its only safety cushion, as this deep aquifer, fossil aquifer, is pumped out. A World Bank report, which is a detailed study of China's water situation, talks about the North China Plain, and it talks about, quote, catastrophic consequences for future generations, end quote, unless water use and supply can be quickly brought back into balance. So the water issue is a real issue for China. We estimate that 130 million Chinese are being fed with grain produced by overpumping. In effect, China, like a number of other countries, has artificially inflated its grain production by overpumping, which by definition is a short-term phenomenon. So we're looking at a situation where China's going to be losing irrigation water in the years ahead, and it's going to make it much more difficult for them to maintain their grain production. The other thing the Chinese decided to do in 1995 was they essentially decided to abandon the soybean. And instead of trying to expand production, they concentrated all their efforts on grain. Four numbers tell this story. In 1995, China was producing 14 million tons of soybeans and consuming 14 million tons of soybeans. In 2010, 15 years later, they're still producing 14 million tons of soybeans, but consuming 70 million tons, which means they're importing 56 million tons, or roughly 80% of all the soybeans they consume. Importing 56 million tons of soybeans in terms of land and water equivalent is equal to importing 140 million tons of grain. So China is now heavily dependent on soybean imports. This enormous growth in soybean consumption in China has led to a restructuring of agriculture in the Western Hemisphere. In the United States, we now have more land in soybeans than in wheat. Brazil has more land in soybeans than in all grains combined. Argentina, this past year, had twice as much land in soybeans as in all grains combined. The bottom line here is that in the Western Hemisphere, this is from Canada south through Argentina, the entire Western Hemisphere, we now have more land in soybeans than any other crop, more land in soybeans than in wheat, more land in soybeans than in corn. These three countries, the U.S., Brazil, and Argentina, account for roughly 80% of the world's soybean harvest today. And they account for 90% of all soybean exports. Worldwide, 60% of all soybean exports go to China. China totally dominates world soybean consumption and world soybean imports today. China has another... Let me just sum up on the soybean. What has happened with the soybean demonstrates what can happen potentially with grain as China turns to the outside world. One other constraint that China is now facing on the grain front is that its rice yields, which has raised dramatically over the last 30 years, its rice yields are now very close to those of Japan, almost exactly the same. Japan's rice yields, which increased for many decades, flattened out or plateaued 16 years ago, and they've not been able to raise them since then. Japanese farmers are using all the available technology, and there's not anything else they can do to raise yields. With China's rice yields now almost the same as those in Japan, I anticipate that their yields, rice yields, are also going to plateau. This means the rice part of their grain harvest, and the big three grains are rice, wheat, and corn in China, the rice part will no longer be expanding. Another problem, and this is a relatively new one in terms of its scale that the Chinese face, is the extraordinary growth in their automobile fleet. A decade ago, they were selling, I don't know, maybe 2 or 3 million cars a year. In 2009, there were 14 million cars sold. In 2010, 18 million. This year, they expect 20 million. This is more. This rate of automobile sales is far above anything the United States has experienced. Adding 20 million cars to the fleet means paving at least 1 million acres of land for roads, highways, and parking lots. So these huge annual jumps in the size of the automobile fleet are requiring the paving a lot of land. This is another reason why it's going to be difficult for China to expand grain production very much in the future. Yet another problem they're facing is an internal economic problem, namely that rural wages are rising. And so in many situations, there are no longer any young people to help with the farming. And so we are getting the abandonment of some of the smaller plots of land and some of the more marginal land because it simply does not pay anymore. On the demand side, the demand for grain and soybeans is continuing to be very rapid. China is adding 8 million people a year, which is small for a country of 1.4 billion, but it is still an additional 8 million people a year. But the big impact on the demand for grain is that most of China's 1.4 billion people are now moving up the food chain. They're consuming more grain-intensive livestock products. They have been moving so fast that with some basic sources of animal protein, they've actually caught up with the U.S. in per capita terms. In China this year, egg consumption per person, pork consumption per person, and seafood consumption per person will be equal to that in the United States. Almost half the world's pork is now produced in China. Basically, half the world's pigs today live in China. The enormous growth in seafood consumption has come largely from fish farming. Farmed fish output in China today far exceeds that in all the rest of the world combined. It is totally dominant, and it has been the key to raising per capita consumption to the U.S. level over the last decade or two. There are three livestock and poultry products where the Chinese are still have a huge potential to develop. One is milk production. The Chinese are developing an appetite for dairy products, importantly ice cream, and their milk production has tripled over the last decade, but in per capita terms, it's less than one-tenth of U.S. milk consumption. Beef consumption in China is one-tenth of U.S. beef consumption, so with both beef and milk, there's a huge potential for growth. Their poultry consumption per person is one-fifth that in the United States, so still a lot of potential there. So we can anticipate substantial further rapid growth in China's grain consumption, most of it to expand beef, dairy, and poultry production. Turning to the market for grain is, in the eyes of most analysts now, I think, inevitable for China. And this is analysts from the U.S. grain industry, from international financial institutions, our own analyses all indicate that China's going to have to turn to the world for a substantial share of its grain. Even if it's only one-fifth of its total grain consumption, which is roughly 400 million tons, China would have to import 80 million tons of grain. One-fifth would compare with four-fifths of their soybean consumption being imported. If they come into the world market for tens of millions of tons of grain, they will have to come to the U.S. because the United States is far and away the world's largest grain exporter. Exporting almost as much grain as Canada, Argentina, and Australia combined. This, having to depend on the United States for grain, would be a nightmare for the Chinese. because it's sort of their worst worst case scenario coming true. But I don't think they can avoid it any longer. Ironically, their nightmare could become our nightmare. That is a nightmare for U.S. consumers. Because what we're looking at is the prospect of competing with 1.4 billion Chinese with fast-rising incomes for our grain harvest, driving up our grain prices and our food prices. Now, in the past, when faced with something like this, as we were in the mid-1970s, where we had a serious domestic food price inflation because of a tight world supply, we restricted exports. I remember banning exports of soybeans to Japan entirely, and we were their sole supplier. So that would be tempting. The problem is that in thinking about doing this with China, we have to remember that China is our banker today. Each month, when the U.S. Treasury Department auctions off Treasury securities to cover our fiscal deficit, China is one of the big buyers. As a result, the Chinese today hold over $900 billion worth of U.S. Treasury securities. China is our banker. And like it or not, we're going to be sharing our grain harvest with the Chinese in the years immediately ahead, as we already are on a huge scale with our soybeans. For Americans, cheap food is almost part of our birthright. We are the world breadbasket. We've never had a food crisis in this country. We've always had an abundance of cheap food, and we've come to take it for granted. But that period may be about to come to an end, because even Americans may be facing substantial rises in incomes. When we combine the growing U.S. demand for grain, internal demand for food and for feed, the looming Chinese demand for U.S. grain, and the growing conversion of U.S. grain into fuel for cars, we begin to see a real price crunch in the making. We're also looking at rising costs of oil, rising consumer expenditures for energy as well as for food, and we're looking at the cost of higher cost of food production, because we do have an oil-based agricultural slash food economy from production through transportation, processing, marketing, etc. And what we now face is a situation we've not faced before when prices have tightened, which is that the price of grain is now tied to the price of oil, because with the massive capacity we have to convert grain into oil, i.e. ethanol, if it is more profitable to convert grain into fuel, we will do that. And as the price of oil and therefore the price of gasoline rises, this will become more and more profitable. We now have oil prices at over $100 a barrel. They could, at some point in the future, go to $150, or even, as some financial institutions have projected, to $200 a barrel in a matter of years. That would then increase the price of ethanol, pulling up the price of grain. So, like it or not, the price of grain is now directly tied to the price of oil. When we put these things together, we can easily imagine a situation where rising food prices and rising oil prices together will increase consumer expenditures on both food and oil and have the effect of lowering real incomes. Because as we know, middle class incomes in this country have not been rising very much at all now for the last couple of decades. And in that situation, rises in the price of food and the price of fuel could lead to an actual decline in real incomes. So we're, as U.S. consumers, for the first time, looking at a future where we can no longer take cheap food for granted. And we've known for some time that we can't take cheap oil for granted. So these two together, I think, are going to reshape our economic future in ways that we may not have fully anticipated. This effect, obviously, I've been focusing on the U.S., but it will affect the entire world. And this is one of the reasons why I think the food situation is going to be a dominant influence in the world in the years immediately ahead. I think with that, Jennifer, we've gotten some of the basic facts on the table and could take questions if anyone is has some questions.
The question and answer session will be conducted electronically. If you would like to ask a question, please do so by pressing the star key followed by the digit 1 on your touchtone telephone. If you are using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Once again, please press star 1 on your touchtone telephone to ask a question. We'll pause for just a moment to give everyone an opportunity to signal. Once again, if you do have a question at this time, please press star 1 on your touchtone telephone. Our first question will come from Chuck Abbott with Reuters.
Oh, thank you. Good morning.
Hi, Chuck.
Thank you for this opportunity. You mentioned at the start about how this talk of China buying corn, probably U.S. corn, in the past week. Do you have a sense of, this is a multi-part question, do you have a sense of how much corn may be involved in these purchases, which, as you say, have not been officially confirmed, and how large a importer China would be in the near term being in the next year or two, and then if you can look to the medium or longer term, because at one point in your comments you talked about China possibly wishing, you know, tens of millions of tons of corn in the future. So, as I say, like the three intervals here, how much is involved at the moment, how much in the near term, and how much in the medium to long term?
Mm-hmm. There are various estimates made by international analysts, financial institutions, commodity groups, and so forth. The U.S. Grain Council, for example, expects China to move quickly to, I think the figure they use is 9 million tons of feed grain imports, probably almost all corn, within the year or so. I think that's definitely a possibility. The thing is that it's always difficult to, one, get the sort of data you need for China. There is within the grain trade, within China, a strong belief that the corn stocks are substantially overstated. And that's because they're the responsibility of the provincial governors. And whatever their quotas are, they always seem to make. But whether that grain actually exists is in doubt in the minds of Chinese grain traders. So that's one of the difficulties. But I could see this year, with most of the imports coming in the latter part of the year, China importing a good part of 10 million tons. I mean, they already import routinely 2 million tons of barley, most of that for brewing purposes, for example. But I could see several million tons of corn, and they're also buying some wheat. They've already bought, I think, 500,000 tons of Australian wheat this year, and I think there'll be more. So I could see this year being the better part of 10 million tons. And then within a few years, say by 2015, we could be looking possibly at 25 million tons, something, just to pick a number, something of that order of magnitude. And then as we go down the road beyond that, 2020 and beyond, it could continue to climb. One is always a little hesitant with the Chinese because you don't have all the data you would like, at least the reliable data, and you never know quite how they're thinking. My sense is that they would have been in the market for somewhat more grain by now, that is during the first 3 months of this year, had it not been for the near-record prices for wheat and corn and soybeans. And they know that if they come into the market very ostentatiously, you know, and buy, you know, very quickly a few million tons of grain, that it will have an effect on the world market, and that would affect their ability to import. So I think they're trying to figure out how to do it as quietly and inauspiciously as possible.
All right, thank you.
We'll take our next question from Ellen Ferguson with Congressional Quarterly.
Hi, thank you for having the call. I have two questions. First is, you've concentrated on China, but India is also a big country with almost as many people. Do you see there being any sort of additional competition with China for some of the world's grains, or is India looking more self-sufficient or looking for different things? And then the second question that deals with water. You mentioned the fact that China is pumping one of its aquifers, which does not refresh itself. What do you see ahead in general for the world in terms of the availability of water? And if that is going to be a problem for the United States in its western part, you know, in parts of its breadbasket.
Mm-hmm. Let me respond to the U.S. part of the question first. The effect of losing irrigation water on U.S. agriculture will be much smaller than in either India or China, for the simple reason that maybe a fifth of our grain is produced with irrigation, and a lot of that center pivot irrigation in the western plains, those crop circles you see when you fly from Washington to Denver, for example. That irrigation in the western plains in Nebraska, Kansas, and Oklahoma down through the Texas Panhandle is almost all from the Ogallala Aquifer, which is also a fossil aquifer. It's one of the few fossil aquifers in the world. The other big one, of course, is the deep aquifer under the North China Plain. We are losing irrigated area, particularly in the important farm states like Texas and California. Each of those states has lost, to use a round number, I'd say 15% of their irrigated area over the last decade or two. And as a country, I think we're probably in the process of losing irrigated area now, though it's not we don't have enough current numbers to be certain of that. So the effect of losing irrigation water will be important, but not nearly as overriding as in India, where three-fifths of the grain crop comes from irrigated land, or China, where four-fifths of the grain harvest comes from irrigated land. The other thing that's different is that the effect of Indians moving up the food chain is, up until now, has been rather small compared with that of China, partly because India is largely a vegetarian society. So they drink milk and they eat eggs, but they don't eat very much meat. and India is much further. The rise in incomes in India has been relatively small compared with that in China, though it is they are moving fairly rapidly now. The other thing about India is that overpumping is extensive in India, and we use the number of 130 million Chinese being fed with grain produced by overpumping. The World Bank has done the same calculation for India, and they estimate that 175 million people in India are being fed with grain produced by overpumping. So all three of the world's major grain producers, China, India, and the United States, are facing a loss of irrigation water. But it's far more important in China and India than it is in the United States. Worldwide, we think that aquifer depletion and irrigation wells going dry could be the major factor making it more difficult to expand world grain production. Because in addition to China, India, and the United States, there are 15 other countries that are also overpumping. That is, they are artificially inflating their grain production in the short run by overpumping. But when the aquifer is depleted, the rate of pumping is necessarily reduced to the rate of recharge. So all will face adjustments. One of these 15 other countries is Saudi Arabia, which was totally dependent in for its wheat production, and it's been self-sufficient in wheat for more than 20 years, totally dependent on a single fossil aquifer. And that aquifer is now largely depleted. As a result, their wheat production has dropped by two-thirds in the last 3 years. And another year or two, they'll probably be out of the wheat production business altogether and totally dependent on imports. So the water issue, we think, is a major issue for the world. But because it's invisible and out of sight, it's not getting nearly the attention it deserves.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Our next question will come from Agostino Fontevecchio with Forbes.
Hi, Lester. How are you doing? My question came from maybe a more theoretical perspective, but I think it's quite valid. So in the late, in the 19th century, we had Malthus came out to tell us that because population was growing at an exponential rate and agricultural production was growing at a linear rate, that there would be crises and wars and, there would be an equilibrium process in which, population would have to come down to match production. Mm-hmm. As time went by, we realized that production accelerated to the point where it could feed the population growth. So we had technological advances and stuff like that allowed us to feed the population. So my question is, why is this time different? In what sense can we not maybe learn how to use seawater or other sources of water? In what sense can't we use technology to get around this problem?
Mm-hmm.
Why was Malthus wrong, I guess, is the question.
I didn't say he was wrong. That was your decision.
Sorry.
What is particularly disturbing now is that the number of hungry people in the world, which incidentally is far greater today, the number of hungry people in the world today exceeds the world population when Malthus wrote that famous treaty, when was it, 1798 or whenever. But the number of hungry people in the world was declining during the closing decades of the last century. But then as we turned into this century, it began to increase and has been increasing since then. It dropped down to a low of about 825 million. Around the turn of the century, it's now over a billion and climbing. And it's not only that the number of hungry people is increasing, but the rise in food prices is creating political instability. It's been a factor in the political turmoil in the North Africa and the Middle East, it comes up in almost every country as a factor, not as the factor, but as a factor. So the challenge now, and one of the things I haven't mentioned except for rice in Japan and China, is that in the more agriculturally advanced countries, such as in France with wheat or Germany or the UK with wheat, wheat yields, which were rising for decades, that is, wheat yield per acre, have plateaued over the last decade and are no longer increasing. And they're not increasing because the researchers don't have any new technologies to give to farmers, to pass on to farmers so that they can expand production. So we have several countries now where yields are plateauing because the backlog of unused technology has essentially disappeared. Farmers are using everything they can. So we have climate change now. We have rising temperatures that are affecting harvests. We have spreading water shortages. And in some more advanced countries, we have yields plateauing. These trends are all converging to create a tight world food situation. And the basic point I would make, and I made this in a press teleconference a couple of weeks ago, is that this current tight food situation and record or near record world food prices is not event driven. It is trend driven, and the trends are rising, the Earth's rising temperature, falling water tables in a large number of key producing countries, and yields beginning to plateau in some of the more advanced countries. There are other factors at work, but these are among the most important explanations of why food prices are rising as much as they are.
Right, so Malthus is right then.
Well, in the sense that we're having trouble feeding the growth in population, there was a period during the last half of the last century when we were making progress in reducing the number of hungry people, and we have now lost that capacity, at least for the time being. And I do not see anything in prospect that's going to suddenly expand production enough to keep up with the growth in demand. I should also mention that one of the things Malthus did not anticipate was the use of grain to produce fuel for cars, which, along with population growth and rising affluence, have doubled the annual world growth in grain demand from 20 million tons a decade ago, 20 million tons a year, to 40 million tons a year in the last few years.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Once again, ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question at this time, that again is star one. Our next question will come from Bernie Ilgner with Arcadis.
Yes, Lester. Had a question related to fertilization to improve yields around the world and thereby more food for feeding the hungry. And I've read your book 2.0, so my information or question might be dated. And perhaps you've addressed this in your more recent books, and that is, it seems like there are ways to increase yields with more fertilizers, but it also seems to bring environmental pollution and problems, and it just seems like those two would be converging trends that would not be sustainable. I wonder about your response to that.
Mm-hmm. I point out as part of the backdrop to the answer to your question that as the world has urbanized over the last century, keep in mind the beginning of the last century, 1900, a very small part of the world's population was living in cities, and now most of us do, and in some countries 80% of us live in cities. But what that has done, that combined with international trade in grain, that is grain being consumed in countries other than where it's produced, is that we've disrupted the nutrient cycle big time. And so when we export 90 million tons of grain a year, for example, we export 2 or 3 million tons of nutrients, of nitrogen, phosphate, potash, basic plant nutrients. And those nutrients end up in the Nile River outside Cairo or Tokyo Bay or someplace where they're not contributing to production. So we've kind of locked ourselves into a situation where we have to replace the nutrients being lost on the, you know, the wheat fields in Kansas and the corn fields in Iowa with either mined phosphate rock or potash or nitrogen fixed synthetically from the taken from the atmosphere. Now, having said that, there are some countries now, some parts of the world, where fertilizer use is no longer increasing. That's been true in the United States since 1980. It's been true in Europe for much of that period. It's also true in Japan. When we look at the developing world, fertilizer use in China today is more than double that in the United States. And I think that's partly because they're over-fertilizing. They have a lot of small farms who don't test with the precision that U.S. farmers can afford to, for example, on nutrient needs in their crops. India, for example, now uses more fertilizer than the United States. The one part of the world where there is still a substantial potential for raising production with the use of fertilizer is sub-Saharan Africa. And, I mean, the sort of general observation would be that introducing fertilizer on these rather depleted soils in Africa can typically raise yields by a factor of two. That is, can double yields. So there's still some possibility for using fertilizer that will substantially expand production. But in the industrial world, that's pretty much history now.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
We'll move next to Matthew Robertson with Epoch Times newspaper.
Hi. So my question relates to China's looking to use arable land in other countries for its food needs. Is this a big thing? I mean, like the farmers in Africa, for example, is Africa going to be China's food basket, so to speak, or in other countries? Just what role does the arable land outside China play in feeding China's grain needs, like directed by the government?
Right. Good question. What we saw in 2007-08 as grain supplies started to tighten was that a number of exporting countries, like Russia and Argentina for wheat, Vietnam for rice, began to restrict or even ban exports in order to keep their domestic food prices down. And what that did was substantially reduce the exportable supplies of grain, and it created a panic in the importing countries because they realized they could no longer depend on access, free access to the world market to obtain the grain they needed. And so a number of countries, including importantly China, began looking for land in other countries that they could use to produce food to ship back home to themselves. Saudi Arabia, South Korea, China, a dozen other countries, and including more recently India. And what we're now seeing is how difficult it is to start in a country that has no modern agricultural infrastructure. I mean, everyone thinks roads, and obviously you need roads if you're going to get the imports into the land you acquire through these land grabs. And some of them are huge. I mean, they're the size of Belgium. You not only need roads to get inputs in and to get the harvested grain out, you also need a whole modern agricultural infrastructure support system. You need equipment maintenance services and parts and supplies. You need places to store fuel, for example, for use in tractors. If you're irrigating, you need irrigation equipment and maintenance. You also need some source of energy, electricity or diesel oil or something to power the pumps. You need specialists in local plant and diseases local insect problems and so forth. And many of the countries with these land grabs don't have any idea of what's happening. So it's going to take time to build this infrastructure. And that's one thing. The second thing is the World Bank survey of these land acquisitions indicate that only 37% are planned to be used to produce food. The other, the rest will be biofuels or industrial crops of one sort or another. So I was thinking that we might see a big jump in world grain production because of all these land grabs, and there are literally hundreds of them now. But in fact, we have trouble detecting measurable increases anywhere in the world, and this is 3 years after the land grabs began. So we may eventually see some substantial increases in the food supply, but I don't think it will be, I don't think that's imminent, and when it does come, we're probably certainly going to need it.
Okay, thank you.
Our next question will come from Ellen Ferguson with Congressional Quarterly.
Hi. I have two questions. One, I needed a clarification on something you said at the very beginning when you were talking about, I guess it was grain, by 2015. Did you say 20 million tons, or was that 25?
I think I may have said 25 million tons. That's what one of the investment banks or someone put that number out a few days ago. That's consistent with what I think could happen. I mean, it could be faster than that, could be slower than that, but something along those lines seems to me to be a reasonable expectation.
All right, and then the second question, I think this goes back to the person who just asked the question ahead of me. The U.S. ag groups, when they talk about the future, they talk about, you know, the enormous growth in population and the demand that will come with that, that they expect to come with that as a, you know, expanded export market. But, and with the expectation that the United States will be the country to, you know, feed most of the world, do you see the United States remaining a major source of food staples going into the future 20, 30 years, or are there other major players who will be coming in to help feed the world?
It's a good question. I mean, some people look at Brazil and say, oh, look what, you know, Brazil has enormous potential. Brazil does have a lot of potential, and some of that's been realized in you know, the last decade or two, particularly in expanding soybean production. But at the same time, when you look at grain production, Brazil produces maybe 70 million tons of grain. The U.S. produces 400 million tons of grain. And yields in Brazil, grain yields, are far below those in the U.S. And, I mean, it's partly because of soils and the subtropical region in which they're being produced. But I doubt that the big two grain producers in the world are China and the U.S., each producing about 400 million tons of grain. But I doubt that anyone else is ever going to get anywhere near that. India is now number three with just over 200 million tons. Russia is fourth with maybe 90 million tons or so. And then they drop down from there. But one of the things to keep in mind is this sort of glass ceiling that countries seem to be, that the more advanced countries seem to be hitting with yields. And though we have not identified any plateauing yet of grain yields in the U.S. of either corn or wheat, corn being the biggest and wheat being second, it could come at any time. It's very difficult to anticipate when yields will plateau because there's no longer new technology to keep increasing them. So I expect the U.S. will continue to be the principal source of grain for the rest of the world. And what that will probably require at some point will be a restriction on the conversion of grain into fuel for cars. And that may come first in the form of not renewing the credits. Yeah. And then it could come as an actual restriction on how much of our grain harvest we want to convert into fuel for cars, particularly given what we now know about how much oil it takes and how ineffective it is, for example, in reducing carbon emissions. And those were two of the arguments that were made to justify it in the beginning.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And we have no further questions at this time.
Hello, Lester?
Yeah.
Oh, great. They put us back in the line. Takesha, are you there?
One moment.
Okay.
Ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude today's conference. Thank you for your participation.